welcome to North Coast Church. Today, Pastor Chris Brown is bringing the teaching to you, so open up your Bibles and listen in.
They knew that the night would end in murder. What they didn't know is how many bodies would lay dead by morning. And they knew their names were on the list. So every action, every encounter, every step they made was going to be critical. When he finds himself behind enemy lines, when he finds himself in their camp, and they start questioning him, the answers that he had already planned out to give are far from what he actually says. And it's always been one of those scenes to go, how could he do that? And yet to actually put yourself there, I have no idea how I would respond. And we got to go back to that night. We have to go back to those moments. We have to go back to a real life and death situation, his on the line. And the answer to three questions, we're going to determine whether he walked out of there or not. And you got to ask yourself, what would you do? So if you got a Bible, I want to take you back to that dark scene. It's at the end of the book of Mark. So if you've already opened to 1 Peter chapter 3, you're wrong. Put your note sheet in there. We're coming back to it. We're actually starting our book study today of 1 Peter. We're starting it in the book of Mark, chapter 14, verse 66. If you're one of those that likes to flip it and find it, go to the back of the Bible. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, the guys' names, all big books, about two-thirds of the way through the Bible. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. Look for Mark 14. If you're new to this, in the beginning, there's a table of contents that tells you what page number Mark is on. And we're in Mark 14, verse 66. Let me set the scene just a little bit more. There's only 16 chapters in the book of Mark. This is the end of the story. It's been 3 years. 3 years of the life of Jesus. 3 years of him calling his disciples. Some tax collectors, some fishermen, average guys, simply leaving their jobs and following him. 3 years of miracles, 3 years of teaching. The crowd is now split at this point. Some really think he's God in the flesh come to earth. Others can't believe the claims he is making. And they hate him. No matter what side of the line you're divided on, you see the tension building. You see your religious leaders are on the side that hate the blasphemy that he's saying. Hate the fact that he continually says he's God. He continually says no one gets to heaven but through him. He continually says he is by which all men will be judged. The arrogant claims of Jesus are page after page after page. And the crowd has got to decide, is he God like he claims to be? Or is he an arrogant fool who needs to be shut up? And on the road to Jerusalem, the enemy's headquarters, Jesus has told his guys three times, I'm not walking out of the city alive. Make no mistake in the arguments. Who killed Jesus? Did the Jews kill Jesus? Did the Romans kill? Jesus killed Jesus. Jesus knew what he was about, what he was doing, and he was calling the shots. And he already told his group, I will be murdered in Jerusalem. He told them when. He told them how it was going to go down. He said he'd be handed over, he'd be betrayed, he'd be mocked, he'd be beaten, he'd be crucified. And then he said, I'm pulling off Easter in 3 days. And if I can't pull off Easter, pay no attention to the idiot with the false claims. Well, that night, the tension in the city is built. Peter has already swore, if they come for you, I'll die with you. It happened in a garden under torchlight. Jesus told the boys just to pray. He begged God not to go through with the plan God had. God said, son, this is what it's all been about. And when the torches of the soldiers come in the garden, the disciples run. Peter finds himself somewhere in the darkness, somewhere in the thicket, somewhere up against the boulder, heaving chest, running for his life and realizing, I just did the very thing I said I wouldn't do. I just ran from Jesus at the time he needed me most. He knows it's life and death. He's talked himself into going back. He's probably already gone through the answers. When they capture me, when they bring me before the court, when I'm side to side next to Jesus, and they ask, what do I think? I'm going to tell him he's the Son of God. I'm going to tell him I've seen the miracles. I think he's really ready to die. But who he's about to be questioned by, the most unlikely of sources, he didn't prepare for. And it's Mark chapter 14. Verse 66, Jesus has been taken to a mock trial in the dead of night and the dark of morning. He's just claimed to be God. They're beating him. They're mocking him. They're blindfolding him, saying, prophesy, who's hitting you now? And meanwhile, in the courtyard, Peter, has made his way back into the enemy's camp. And while Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. And when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. You also were with that Nazarene Jesus, she said. But he denied it. I don't know. I don't even understand what you're talking about, he said. And then he went out to the entryway. And when the servant girl saw him there, she said again to those standing around, This fellow's one of them. And again, he denied it. Now, after a little while, those standing near said to Peter, surely you're one of them. You are a Galilean. You see, his dialect, his speech must have given him away. You sound like one of the hill folk from the lake. And he began to call down curses on himself. And he swore to them, I don't know this man you're talking about. Now immediately, the rooster crowed the second time. And then Peter remembered the words Jesus had spoken to him. This was earlier that evening. That before the rooster crows twice, you will disown me three times. And he broke down and he wept. And Peter walks out of the scene. And I'm sure he realizes there is a special place in hell for people like him. When Jesus is being beaten, mocked, whipped, his flesh laid open, and you have walked with him for 3 years, and you've come back to that very scene just to call down curses that you don't know the guy, there is a special place in hell for people like Peter. And he exits into the darkness. To his astonishment, it's 3 days later. Easter's pulled off. The tomb is open. The women go in the morning. They find the stone rolled away. And the angels say, go tell the disciples and Peter. Jesus wants to see him again. The only one mentioned by name. And he will get a second shot at this. He will spend 40 days walking with the resurrected Jesus. 40 days with the Jesus that now has scars in his hands and his feet. 40 days of everything falling into place and clicking. 40 days, and one of those days, a long walk on the beach where Jesus just pulled Peter away and said, hey, I got three questions for you. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Because a couple nights ago, you screwed up, and I want you to know I know when we're good. We can do this thing again. And that night, I think, causes his pen to tremble a little bit when 30 years later, he writes us a letter. 1 Peter chapter 3. If you had something there, we turn back to it. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 13. Now, if you're flipping around, it's in the back of the Bible. The last book of the Bible is Revelation. Work backwards by little tiny books. 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, 1st, 2nd Peter. 1 Peter 3:13, the very back toward the end of the New Testament. This same guy will write 30 years later. And he's going to give us a step-by-step what to do if your life is ever questioned about Christianity. And you have to know who's writing it. You see, when I grew up in church, my family was professional Christians. That means we went every time the doors were open. I was forced to go to church. And there was never even an argument. You better be sick with puke in your hands to stay home. Otherwise, you're going to church. None of this, I don't feel good. Dad's like, show me the puke. Get in the car. And so we were in church. And no one ever told me really what the book was about. No one ever told me how these books in the back fit in with the whole story. No one told me. This book, 1 Peter, is written by Peter, the fisherman, the guy that lived the story out. He's about to tell us what to do if you're ever questioned. And no one ever pointed out, remember when he was questioned? Oh, he thought he was going to hell. You know he did. You know he did. You know he walked out of there knowing whatever the last 3 years have been about with church, I have blown it. No one else has ever denied Jesus the moment he's being beaten to death. And that's Peter with curses three times. He knows whatever Christianity is, he's lost his shot at it. And yet he was the only one by name invited back in. For 30 years now, he's been living it out. For 30 years now, he can't keep his mouth shut. For 30 years now, he's answering the questions before they're even asked. I put there underneath learning from Peter's perjury, because I think that's what he did that night. He might not have been the one on trial, but he was in the courtyard. He was the one being questioned, and he was the one lying about who this Jesus was to him. Underneath there, I wrote Acts chapter 2, Acts chapter 3, Acts chapter 4, Acts chapter 5, and it goes on. You see, there's four books that tell the life and story of Jesus: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. After that comes a book called Acts. It's short for the actions of the church, the actions of the disciples once Jesus ascended back into heaven. And Peter becomes the main character. In chapter 2, the disciples are all speaking in tongues. It's called the Day of Pentecost. Everyone in Jerusalem is like, what in the world is going on with these guys? Most of the crowd thinks these guys are just drunk. Some of the crowd goes, they're speaking in my native tongue and language. I'm hearing the Jesus story, and all the visitors to Jerusalem are hearing the Jesus story in their own language through disciples who have never spoken the language. It's a crazy phenomenon. Everyone's bewildered. Someone needs to answer a question, and Peter stands up. He's blown this before. He's not about to do it again. And he goes, hey, everyone, listen up. It's 9 a.m. The guys aren't drunk. Let me tell you what's happening. And he goes back to the Old Testament, and he talks about God said, on that day, his spirit will descend with tongues. His spirit will be upon man. He goes, this is the spirit of God just working right now. Let me tell you why. And he does an entire chapter from Old Testament to his life on who Jesus was, why you killed him, and why you better get it straight this time, just like Peter's going to get it straight this time. At the end of that message, 3,000 people in Jerusalem come forward and say, we want to follow Christ. And they go down the river, and they get baptized that day. Well, the very next chapter, they're going to the temple courts, because that's what you do. You go to the temple, and as they're walking to the temple, they see a crippled man. He's asking for any coin, silver, gold, anything anyone has. And Peter and John stop, and they go, we don't have money, but what we do have, we're going to give you. In the name of Jesus Christ, stand up and walk. And the guy stood up and walked, and they're like, oh! And the guy starts singing and dancing through church, and the whole church is like, that's the crippled dude we walk by every day. Now everyone comes to Peter and John, and they have questions. And Peter silences the church. He goes, hey, don't look at us as if we've done anything. Let me tell you about the Jesus you just killed. And you could have heard a pin drop. And so many people that day realized who this God was. Well, then he gets put in prison. Then he gets called before the Jewish leaders. He gets called before Roman leaders. He gets called the high court. I put the passage down. You got to read. Every time he's called on, he goes, let me tell you the answer. I screwed this one up in front of a servant girl twice and in front of guys at the gate to the court. I'm not screwing this up again. Let me tell you about the man you killed. And he becomes the spokesperson in the book of Acts, the very guy that walked away knowing there's a special place in hell for people like him. And 30 years later, in his old age, he wants to put down in writing, before he leaves, a letter to us, the church. Here's what to do if you're ever in a situation where people ask. And now that you know who's writing it, I think the depth and meaning of these four verses is going to be so much richer. 1 Peter chapter 3, 13. Some of you are like, you're just now reading. I thought you were going to close in prayer. No. This is short. This is only 4 hours today. Here we go. So he writes, now, who is going to harm you if you're eager to do good? But even if you should suffer for what is right, consider yourself blessed. Do not fear what they fear. Do not be frightened. If you're just joining us, we're 11 weeks into the study in the book of Peter. 11 weeks because we're doing about four verses at a time because it's so good. And he just finished saying over the last few weeks, look, following God, understanding who God is and what he wants to do with sinners like us in spite of us is amazing. It's going to change your life. It's going to change your marriage. It's going to change church. And now he stops looking back at what we learned. He goes, by the way, really? What harm's going to come to you if you're living a great life? He goes, just think about it. If you're truly following Christ and living and loving people and being generous and compassionate, what kind of enemies are you really going to have? But then it hits him. We live in a jacked up world. It hits him. He's been in prison numerous times. for just following Jesus. It hits them. Some of you have family members, co-workers, a boss, a supervisor, an ex. Some of you have neighbors. Some of you have people, and they've just made it their goal to make you miserable because of your faith. So it hits them. Following the life and teachings of Jesus, what kind of enemies are you really going to have? But if you should suffer, consider yourself blessed. Because my bet is, Jesus suffered a whole lot more than anything you're going to go through for your faith. And if you're ever questioned, here it goes. But in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Number one, when our lives are on trial, write this down. Make sure that Jesus is the center of our life. If it's our lives ever on trial, if we're ever asked, make sure Jesus is the center of our life. Now, here's my problem with that. You go to church and go, hey, you know, do you believe in God? Do you believe Jesus is God? Yes, yes, we're good. No, no, you're not good. That's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. The Bible's not saying believe Jesus is God. Peter's not saying believe in God. In fact, the book of James, one other book to the left, says even the demons believe in God and they shudder. They tremble at his name. Think about that. Have you ever thought of your belief in God? And you ever thought that your belief in God, the demons outbelieve you? Does that make them better Christians? You think we're going to get to heaven and go, man, there's a lot of demons in here. Didn't think they'd be around. What are demons? What is the evil? It's fallen angels. They have actually seen God. They have been in his presence. They understand God at a depth, a personal experience, far beyond any of us. They believe and they tremble at his name. Peter's not challenging us to believe in God. Peter's not saying, hey, believe that Jesus is God. In fact, I wrote it this way underneath. There is a huge difference between believing in God and having a Lord. A huge difference between believing in God and having a Lord. Peter says, here's the first thing you got to understand. The very basic understanding of Christianity. You set apart in your hearts Christ as Lord. Not firmly believe in God. Because demons believe in God. You set him apart as Lord. And I think we've lost something in that terminology because we don't have a lordship system really happening today. You have to go back to the days of feudalism. You have to go back to a days where you were a servant, where someone else owned the land. A lord owned the property. You were allowed to work it. You were allowed to plow it. You were allowed to have raised livestock on it. But make no doubts about it. Someone else owned you and all there was. You had a complete sworn allegiance as a vassal to your lord. Christianity took that term of ultimate ownership, brought it into what was happening and saying, it's not just ownership. When Jesus is Lord, he has absolute authority. He is sovereign. He's got exclusive jurisdiction to all that we are, all that we have. That is far, far different than saying, oh, I believe in God. Oh, I believe Jesus is God. Peter goes, I don't care if you believe Jesus is God. The demons, I'll believe you. Have you set him apart as Lord? North Coast, all the campuses, all the venues, let me just ask. We're not raising hands. You don't have to answer out loud. It's a self-test. You can grade this one at home. Have you set apart Jesus Christ and his words to have absolute exclusive authority and ownership of every aspect of your life? Never to be challenged, never to be denied, never to be questioned, never rebutted, but sovereignty, Lord, set apart from everything. From who I am, from what I do, to what I speak, to my money, to my job, to my talents, because I realize it's his. I'm allowed to manage a very small piece of the Lord's kingdom that he is allowing me to squat on, if you will. That's a Lord. That's a Lord. Jesus didn't die on the cross to be God. He was already God. Jesus didn't die on the cross so that we'd believe in him. Jesus died on the cross to pay for everything I've done, to buy me back so he has 100% complete ownership, full title authority, exclusive rights to everything that is Chris. He died to own me. Every part of it. And a Lord isn't part of your life. If a Lord is part of your life, he is not a Lord, because a Lord is over set apart all of your life. And what Peter's been doing for three chapters is bringing us to this point, saying, make sure in your hearts to set apart Christ as Lord. Is there an attitude, an action, a behavior, a relationship in your life where he is not Lord of? Because if he is not Lord of areas of your life, then I would challenge you to debate me on this, then he's not Lord of your life. He may be governor of a couple places of your life, and that's not what he died for. He died for ownership. Not that I have to be perfect. He doesn't want my perfection, but he wants the direction of my life. That I go, God, everything you say and are, you are Lord, and I yield to it, especially in the areas that don't make sense to me or I don't like or I disagree with, and there are plenty. Those are the areas I say you're Lord, and I manage it, and it's your life, and here we go. And Peter jumps to that. Let me read Luke 9, 23 through 26. Jesus said it this way with the crowd that was following him. In your note sheet, Luke 9, 23, 26, he said to the crowd, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny himself, take up their cross daily, and follow me. You see, whoever wants to save their life has to lose it. And whoever loses their life for me, that's who's going to save it. What good is it for someone to gain the entire world and yet at the end lose or forfeit their very self? And let me tell you, whoever is ashamed of me and my words, said Jesus, I will be ashamed of them when I come in my glory, in the glory of the Father and the holy angels. I love where Jesus said, look, this wasn't saying a prayer when you were six. This wasn't when you were at junior high camp in Indian Village, your counselor led you to say a prayer to believe in God. Those are great. It wasn't something your mom and dad had you recite when you were 5 years old. He goes, those are great starts, beginnings. He said, this is a daily. Not did you ever say a prayer and say, I believe in God. Are you daily picking up your cross, which is an act of surrender? It means someone else owns you. No one picks up a cross on their own. So you're under someone else's authority. You die to yourself. There's a cross daily where I have to get rid of Chris in order to follow Christ. And if I can't follow Christ, then I'm back following Chris. Chris is Lord of my life. It's just a T difference, but man, what a difference it makes. You probably got a lot more letters to change, so I'm way ahead of some of you. I just got to get rid of that following Chris attitude and go, man, it's got to be. And he goes, Chris, that's going to be daily for you. And then he gives that warning. But if you're ashamed of me and my words, don't be surprised when I return that you're not part of this. And I will be ashamed of you and the life that you lived. I always get to these sayings of Jesus and go, man, it's so audacious. It's so arrogant. At times it seems like he asks so much. And yet when I put it down into human relationships, it makes so much sense to me. My voice is a little shot. And one and I get through the next services just going, Friday night I did an all-nighter with seventh grade girls at Knott's Berry Farm. Wasn't my choice. Roosevelt Middle School, seventh grade class. Went to Knott's Berry Farm. They had an all-nighter there. My seventh grade daughter came home with a permission slip and said, Dad, you can be a chaperone. You can take our group. And there's two voices in my head. There's a job voice that goes, I'm teaching. I'm teaching Saturday. And she looks at me and she goes, so you can go Friday? And there's a dad voice in my head that goes, in the next couple years, your daughter's going to be so embarrassed of having you around her friends. You may want to take this opportunity. And I look at her and go, yeah, I'll go with you. So at right after school at 3:30 in the afternoon, we get in buses and we're going to Knott's Berry Farm all night. And I've got a troop of seven seventh grade girls. If you're not used to that, like I am not, may I remind you, seventh grade girls scream just standing still. No reason at all. When you put them on rides, my ears are still ringing. They're still ringing from this troop of girls. And I'm walking around in the dead of the morning, and they're like, look, the line's short over there. And I'm like, that's because no one should be alive right now. And we're going on these rides. We get out in front of the Calico Courthouse. It's kind of the big Times Square area of Knott's Berry Farm, the theme park. It's a big open area. And I give my phone to my seventh grade girl. I go, Sayla, I'm going to jump on that stage, and I want you to take a picture of me. And she's all, why? Well, just do it. So I jump on the stage, takes a picture. Come on, I go, we're going to text this to Mom. And I said, that exact spot is where I proposed to your mom 19 years ago. On stage, New Year's Eve, in the middle of a concert, they called me up, and I proposed to your mom right on that stage, right on this spot. So we took a picture, text Amy, will you still be married to me? Love, Chris. Because sometimes I'm not sure. And so, and it's so cool to stand there with my seventh grade girl and go, this is, you're from this. This is where it starts. Crazy! Crazy! And I started thinking about that. What if for the last 19 years, I never mentioned Amy to anybody? What if my relationship was every time I left the house and left her inside, I never brought her up publicly? In fact, a lot of friends and coworkers aren't even sure if I'm married. Every time the topic comes up, I avoid it. I turn to sports. I turn to something else. I just make excuses. And they think I'm married because they know I have a house and at times seem to get glimpses of family, but they're not sure. And I never bring her up in a conversation to anyone, any place. How would that make Amy feel? Well, of course, humanly, we get it. Well, nothing would break a woman's heart more than just to realize, you stay in the house, and out here, no one even's going to know about our relationship. It's exactly what Jesus is saying. He goes, whoa, whoa, whoa. You've set me apart as Lord over your life. I own you. But if you say you believe in God, you just believe in God. I believe Jesus is God. But you live a life that's ashamed of me or my words. He goes, let me tell you, I'm ashamed of that life and of you. And relationally, we get it. How much I talk about Amy because the difference she's made in my life. How much I talk about her all the time because who she is and what she means to me. And that is a mere woman I'm married to that pales in comparison to the creator of the universe who owns me, who's given me eternity and salvation. That is simply a daughter of the king, let alone the king himself. And Jesus goes, yes, I'm making that statement. You set me apart of Lord of your life, all of it. Ownership, exclusive, absolute authority rights to all of you. And there will be a time where you need to share that and speak it. Because it will have a difference on your life. And Peter runs to that. In your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you. Secondly, live a life that begs a question. Live a life that begs a question. Peter goes, if you set apart Christ as Lord of your life, then people are going to start asking about it. He assumes, he knows, if we are really living as people that are owned by God in his word, you're going to be different and people are going to notice. People are going to notice. Christians are different. So many times Christians come to me, and I know I've said it before, but they're like, oh, the state that we're in, and Christmas isn't being used anymore. And Christians are, I love kind of where our society is going. Christianity, I think in the next 10 to 20 years, is going to mean something. I think it's going to mean something. It hasn't in the last 50 in America. You're a Christian? Yeah, we're all Americans. It means nothing. The split between our culture and Christianity, that chasm is growing at such a rapid pace. Christianity will mean something and it will cost us something. And I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to saying Merry Christmas and people looking at me with a gasp. Oh, I can't believe you said that. And I'm like, no, I'm putting lights on the outside of my house. This is good. Now I'm hanging Christmas stuff. And Peter says, in this culture, if he's set apart as Lord, you're no longer Lord of your life. People will ask a question. Be ready for that. Are you different enough from the world around us where it is obvious to those that come in relationship with you? If all of my allegiance in life is directed by God, and our society says we all play gods, we pick what we want to do, what we don't want to do, you can be Lord of your life. This should be so different. There's going to be questions about it. Why do you do this? Why do you go there? Why don't you do this? Why is this different with you? Why do you always do this? There's going to be questions. I remember when this first dawned on me, I was about 21, 22 years old, something like that. It was Halloween night. I had to be back in 90, 91, something like that. I was driving heavy equipment. I was driving tractors. I was doing fire breaks out of a work site in Fallbrook, and I loved just driving tractors and pushing down brush. And the guy I was doing that with was a guy named Jim Troilo. And I loved Jim. Jim was the coolest dude. And here's what I knew. I knew enough about my upbringing to know that I was a Christian, even though I was a secret undercover Christian that no one knew. Yeah, I'm not even sure if that's a definition. And I knew Jim didn't know God, and I didn't want Jim to go to hell. And I've been thinking about, how do I get Jim to know God? But I can't really tell him about God because he knows my life doesn't have anything to do with God. But I said a prayer when I was little, so one day I get a big house. Well, that was my understanding of Christianity. Say a prayer when you're little, really mean it, and one day you get heaven. I've never found a verse like that, but that's what I was taught in Sunday school. So a friend of mine was putting together a concert, a Christian punk band called One Bad Pig. I don't know how they didn't make it big, but... And he goes, the lead singer's got this incredible testimony about what his life used to be, and then he found God, and in the middle of the concert, he's going to give it, and it's going to be a great opportunity for people to hear about Jesus. And I thought, that's what Jim needs. Jim will go to a concert with me. So I go by Jim's house, and after work, I go, dude, there's a concert going on. You got to come with me. Let's go. And he's like, no, I'm going to stay home. I'm like, dude, it's Halloween. We're too cheap to get out candy. We're not going to dress up and go get candy. Come with me to the concert. He goes, no, I'm just going to hang out here in the apartment with my girlfriend. I go, no, you got to come. He's not coming. His roommate at the time was listening, a guy named Ken. Now, I hated Ken. I was a type of Christian. I was an undercover Christian whose life didn't show it, and I hated people. And there's a lot of us. And I still called myself a Christian. And Ken's listening. Ken's all, hey, I got nothing to do. I'll go to the concert with you. And I'm like, nah, I'm not going. Here's Ken. Ken had a lifestyle. I mean, I was an idiot, jerk, arrogant guy at that age. But Ken had a lifestyle that just blew mine out of the water. And what he did with women, what he did with his life, I mean, he was a bum. He was a jerk of a guy. And he was a Mr. Clean guy. Where every time we'd have Roberto's or Rolled Tacos or wrappers on the, you know, and we're watching TV, he'd come in, why is there wrappers all over? And I'm like, because it's a bunch of 20-year-old dudes in an apartment, Mom. And we didn't like each other. And he's like, I want to go to the concert. And I go, no, I'm not going. He goes, yeah, you are. You're going. I go, no, I'm not going anymore. And he grabbed his jacket. He goes, I'm going with you. And I'm like, dang it. So we go to the concert. It's a pretty cool concert. This guy stops. This guy gives his little spiel. It's a cool story, man, what God's done and changed his life. And if you want to know this Jesus, we're going to ask you right now just to come down to the very front. We're going to say a prayer and ask you. And I look over and Ken's got this little tear in his eye. And I'm like, oh, here it goes. I've seen the Christian stuff. You get all warm, fuzzy, you go say a prayer and you go back and you live your life and he's going to fall into it. And Ken looks at me and he goes, I think I need to say that prayer. And I'm like, you do. And he's all, you want to go with me? And I'm all, no, you can do this on your own, dude. I'll stand right here. And he goes, I think you need to say that prayer. And I looked at him and I said, I've said that prayer. And he looked at me and he goes, really? And now I really like the guy. And I'm all, go get saved, you idiot. And he walked down and he said a prayer. And I sat there in the back of the concert and it hit me. Chris, your life begs a question. And the question my life was begging was, when are you going to say that prayer? I said it when I was little, grew up in a Christian home, knew all the stories. Didn't have a life that showed it, and Ken knew it. And Ken was surprised when he found out I called myself a Christian. And I stood in the back of that concert and I realized, I think everyone's pretty surprised that I call myself a Christian. He's not Lord of anything in my life. I believe in God and I said a prayer to him, and I better get a big house when it's all said and done. Ken and I started doing Bible studies, started going to church. We actually became roommates. I started to like the guy. Ken came home one day and said, I'm giving up architecture. I'm gonna be a youth pastor. And I sat Ken down and I said, no. Youth pastors are really cool guys. Kids like them. They're funny. They're usually athletic. They're popular. You're none of that. Keep being an architect. He's like, thanks for the advice. I'm like, well, that's what I'm here for. He came back a few weeks later. He goes, I'm going to Bible school. And I'm like, all right. I don't know for how many years now. It's close to 20, though. There's a big church down in San Diego called Shadow Mountain Community Church. Ken was the junior high pastor there for about 15 years, 300 junior hires in his group. Now he's the family life pastor overseeing all their ministries of that church. One of the most amazing guys in my life. And I tried to talk him out of it. And little did he know, the surprised look on his face when I said I'd already said the prayer was what I needed at that point in my life. You see, your life already is asking a question. You just have to ask yourself, what question is it asking? Is it a surprise that you call yourself a Christian when you live and act no different than the world? Or is your life set apart because you have a Lord over everything? Your life lives according to it. And in this day and age, it's becoming obvious. You do things differently. When it comes to how you love others, your generosity, your marriage, your family, your singleness, your sexuality, you see yourself as truly managing someone else's part of the kingdom, not owning any of it yourself. And Peter sits down and goes, church, listen, 30 years ago I blew this one big time. I thought I was destined to hell. I didn't think there's any hope for a guy that curses Jesus at the same place and time he's being beaten. And I was the only one mentioned my name to come back. And I've been doing this for the last 30 years. And before I die, he sits down and he starts to write. Here's how to make sure you're in the same situation. Live a life where you have a Lord. My assumption is then, that's a life that's going to beg a question. And when the questions are asked, here's how you answer it. Be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you, to give the reason for the hope that you have. Three things in there. I just put it this way. And number three, give our hope an answer to anyone who asks. And this is where some of us are going to start checking out. Give your hope an answer to anyone who asks. And this is where we get down to people going, oh, that's for preachers. Oh, that's for evangelists. There's a big word in Christianity called apologetics. It simply means how to defend your faith, how to give answers, how to give reasons for what you believe. And every time we hear big words like apologetics, it's for the brainiacs in the group that can go back and debate people about evolution and creationism and science and flood narratives. And it's like, I have no idea about carbon dating and old earth, new earth. And I'm out. And that's not what Peter's saying at all. In fact, I'm going to run you through this real quickly. And every one of you are going to walk out of here going, man, I can do that. I already have it down. I didn't even know it. The very first thing we got to understand is be prepared. Be prepared. We got to be strategic about this. Live a life that's different because we have a Lord. And in that, be prepared. Somebody someplace at time is going to ask us about it. Why didn't you go along with the company policy of doing this way? Why didn't you treat the client this way? Why did you give money back? Why did you make it a win-win? How come you didn't do? Why aren't you doing? When we go out, you don't usually, you fill in the blank. There's going to be something. It's going to come up. And you have to be prepared. You have to go, I got to be strategic. When this comes up, our job of Christians is being salt and light. This is how the church spreads. This is how the good news spreads. God's going to bring someone into my life that needs him. God doesn't zap people into Christians all across the culture. He brings somebody that needs God in their life, in their marriage, in their finances, in their health, in their fears, in their addiction. Somebody is going to be next to you in life. And when you're living life with your Lord, he's going to have them bump into you. And that bumping in is going to result in a conversation. And you got to be ready to say something. Be prepared. And you go, well, be prepared with it. I'm not good at this. I don't know a lot of the Bible. Number two, give reasons. Give reasons. Be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reasons for the hope that you have. You go, Chris, I don't know chapters and verses. Sometimes I can find stuff, but I'm not good with the numbers or the book. That's not what I'm saying. My favorite story on this is a guy named Brownlow North. Brownlow North was born in 1810 in Ireland. And from 1810 to 1854, this guy was kind of a hellion. This guy was a drinker. This guy was a gambler. This guy loved to ride the countryside. He loved to hunt. He was a man's man. And he was just out living his life. Brownlow North had a friend, though, that was a Christian. And from time to time, he was interested in sitting with him and finding out, why are you still following this stuff? And one night over dinner, Brownlow North just happened to ask him, okay, why then I pray at times God doesn't answer me? And his friend simply looked at him and said, Brownlow, it's because every time you pray, it's for God to help the life you're living. God doesn't want to help the life you're living. He wants your life. It was a simple statement. But man, it hit Brownlow pretty hard. And at the age of 44, Brownlow North had this incredible conversion in his life where he gave up everything he was about and doing and started following Christ. Now, here's what he started to find out. As with most gamblers, drinkers, hunters, he can tell a good story. And when Brownlow North started telling the story about his life and what God's doing, people started listening. And people started inviting Brownlow to share. He started learning about Scripture, started learning about God, but his stories were outgrowing his education, and people were asking him to share his testimony. So he's invited to the church in Aberdeen, a big church back where he was growing up. And he was excited about going back home and sharing. He had a message planned, and during the first songs, a piece of paper hits his shoulder and falls onto his lap. And he looks over his shoulder just to see a little gray-haired lady go back down the side aisle and sit a few rows behind him. And she just glared at him. And he opened up the paper and he started reading it. It said, Dear Mr. North, how dare you come back here to our house of the Lord? If you set one foot on our pulpit, I will stand up and let the church know everything I know about you. And there it had bullet points of things he did as a teenager, in his 20s, in his 30s, as a young man, signed. Well, the song finished, and he immediately walked up on stage, got behind the pulpit, and said, I was going to start with the sermon today. Instead, I'd like to read you a letter. And he read the letter word for word, and he held it up at the end, and he goes, every one of those stories is true. In fact, I can write pages and pages of other stories just like those. Instead, today, I want to tell you about the God that has forgiven that, given me freedom of it, and how you can find him too. And the church sat silent, except for one lady who got up and went out the back. And he shared his story. That was the guy who was prepared with reasons for being a Christian. You see, thirdly, his reasons, be personal. Be personal. You are all the testimony you need to know. I don't care how many verses you have memorized. I don't care what you can debate of science or creationism or evolution. I don't care what you can go back in the historicity of the Bible or where we got it from or the evidence of a crucifixion or of Easter. You are the only story you need. Be personal. Be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give reasons for the hope that you have. This is your story. Be prepared to share it. I started thinking of it. We even call it giving testimony. That's a judicial term. And so I called Terry Peters, a family that comes to North Coast, Carlsbad venue. Her kids are amazing in our youth ministry leadership. She is a defense attorney. I've been in the courthouse several times recently where I've been asked to be a witness or to provide some character stuff for somebody. And I've watched her in action, and she's a spark plug in that courtroom. And I thought, if I'm ever sitting there and I need a defense attorney, I want her by me. It's not a goal of mine, but if I'm ever there, I want this lady next to me, man. She is a spark plug. And so I called her up and I go, hey, Terry, in the court of law, if someone's called to give testimony, what can they or can't they do? And she goes, oh, everything that a witness has is governed by an evidence code. Every state has an evidence code, and the federal government has an evidence code. And that gives you the parameters of what is credible, of what is reliable for a witness to share. Everything has to fall inside the evidence code. And I go, I see a bunch of court stuff on TV where people are like, I object, Your Honor. I go, so what are the objections to someone giving a testimony? She goes, here's the main ones. Number one, objection is hearsay. I object because of hearsay all the time. You can't say what someone else told you, what you heard someone else say. She goes, that's hearsay. There are exceptions to that, but that's a hearsay rule. I don't want to know what someone else told you or what you heard. Objection, hearsay. And I'm writing it down. I'm like, that's good. I go, what else? She goes, lack of foundation. I go, what's lack of foundation? If you start to tell me about an event that you weren't physically part of, I object for lack of foundation. You can't tell me a story unless you can put yourself in the story. And she goes, then I want to know, where were you, what time it was, what was your perception of it, what was the visibility, how close were you to the scene? You have to be in it, otherwise it's objected, it's lack of foundation. And I'm writing that down. I go, what's another one? She goes, I object for speculation. Speculation is when someone starts giving something that's not personal. They start assuming, they're making assumptions about something in life. They start guessing and putting things together. She goes, that's speculation. I don't want your guesses or assumptions. And I'm all, that is good. And I realize that's all we're talking about today. Live a life that begs a question. When you live a life where he's Lord, people are going to ask. In the midst of that, then, simply be prepared, give reasons, and make it your testimony. And what I mean is this. Don't start out with simply saying, well, my pastor once told me, or my growth group leader, I object. That's hearsay. Don't tell anyone what your church believes or what your pastor taught you. That's hearsay. Objection. That's not a testimony. Well, I know in the Bible when Jesus was doing the miracles, objection, lack of foundation. Were you there? Did you see a miracle? Were you one of the 12? Then shut up. Don't want to hear about it. When I know a bunch of Bible stories, who cares? It's not in the evidence today. Well, I grew up in a Christian family. I went to a Christian school and church, and I'm a objection, speculation. You're assuming things. I want to know about you. If you've ever been on a jury, right when they dismiss you, they give you the jury instructions on everything you've heard in the trial, what you have to do about it now. One of the jury instructions say this, the testimony of one witness whom you believe to be credible is sufficient proof for any fact. All it takes is one witness whom you think is credible. That in our court system is sufficient proof for any fact on the case. One witness is all it takes for a life sentence or an acquittal. One. And Peter writes, I was ready for the high priest and to be standing next to Jesus. And it was a seventh grade girl who tripped me up. Who said, aren't you one of them who follow him? It was a crowd at the gateway who recognized my speech as being different. And when they asked about it, I changed my speech. And 30 years later, he writes, live a life that asks questions. Be prepared to tell them. You want to know facts? Here's facts. She used to hate me, and now she likes it when I hold her hand. It's been 3 years, and I like going home again. Here's facts. Well, here's how I used to see my job and do my business, treat my employees or my boss. Here's how I see it today. That's facts. Here was my life when I was Lord. Here is my life now that I've made him Lord. You ought to come listen and check it out. That is facts. Now, some of you, if someone says, why is your life different? You're going to say, do you have time for coffee? And you will sit down and unfold 2 hours of the most amazing Bible study. From Old Testament to New Testament to your life and God. And I wish I had it on tape because the world should see it. And you're amazing. But so many of us go, I think mine's 5 seconds. My life used to suck. Now it doesn't. That's what's done. Now let's be honest. Which one of those is a better testimony? And they're both equal. Because someone that's asking you is going to see you as a credible source. And all it takes is the witness of one to say, here's who I used to be, here's who I am, and here's why. Here's what's changed. My actions are changed. My spending has changed. My marriage has changed. I feel better about life. I sleep like a baby at night. You ought to come check it out. That's a testimony. That's ironclad. that is being witnessed. And it amazes me. At the end of those 40 days of Jesus being back out of the tomb with them, he takes them up to a mountainside and he says, I have all power on heaven and earth. And I wonder if the hair stood up on the back of their necks. And he goes, and here's my plan. You go do it. I'm sending you. You go live a life with the Lord. They're going to ask a question. And you tell them why your life's changed. That's the church. That is God's plan A for North County. There is no plan B. And just when you're armed with the truth and go beating people up with it, Peter adds this. But do this with gentleness and respect. Verse 16, keeping a clear conscience so that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of their slander. Our attitude is just as important as our words. Last and number four. Peter goes, now your attitude is just as important as your words. You do this with gentleness. And you do this with respect. You do this with respect to their lifestyle, to their choices, to their religion, to their beliefs, to their preferences. You do it with gentleness and you do it with respect. And you share truth. And you share truth. Where do we get the story of Peter's failure? Mark 14. Who is Mark? Mark was the young man that walked with Peter for all of his preaching and all of his teaching. Where do we get Peter's failure? From Peter. He said, print it. That's where I was. Let me tell you where I ended up. And let me tell you, if you're ever called in question, as you should be, here's how to answer. Because there's somebody around your life who needs Jesus. And Jesus is done walking the streets. He now does it in us and through us. And when we set him apart as Lord, he will bring that somebody into your life. And you will bump into each other. And there'll be a question. And you have everything you need to answer. Because your life is different from when you were Lord to now. He is being Lord. And you share that. And the testimony of one witness, whom is seen credible, is sufficient to prove any facts. You're not just in the family. You're not just allowed to be part of the kingdom. You are the front lines of greeting others into it. And our life has to show it. And be ready to answer the question when it comes. Father, thanks. I don't get it. I don't understand it. I know I don't deserve it. So once again, for your grace, your forgiveness, thanks. As we go into worship with one last song, may some of us just take an inventory. Are there things in our life where it's obvious you are not Lord? And if you are not Lord of parts of our life, we have not made you Lord of our life. May it be a daily prayer of waking up and following you. May you bring us to a point where our life is different. Where friends and family and neighbors and co-workers, even those we don't like and would rather not invite to the concert, come with a life change that you work in amazing ways. God, thanks for allowing us not just in the family, but being allowed to greet others in as well. Give us strength and courage to do it for your name, for your glory, not ours. Amen.
So before we close, if you want more information about this teaching or any other teaching, just go online, www.northcoastchurch.com. Or you can come see us at 2405 North Santa Fe Avenue in Vista, California. Check the website for times of services. And now let's get back to some closing thoughts from Pastor Chris.
As you go, we're going to pick it up from there next week. I just love the little timeout right in the middle of the book of 1 Peter. It's almost where he just got so personal, going, guys, I blew this before. My life begged a question. I failed miserably. This incredible God gave me grace, forgiveness, and freedom from it, and a second chance. And let me tell you what it's done for me. And his encouragement to us, regardless of how many times we feel like we've blown it before, to have this opportunity to say, God, I am yours. If there's an area of your life that is shouting against any evidence of Christianity and lordship. Man, I challenge you today. Ask forgiveness. That cross covers it. It covers it. And to walk with him and allow it to be part of your testimony for you, not against you. So we're going to pick it up from there next week. Until then, turn around, greet someone else who's been subpoenaed. See you next week.